All right, so this morning we're going to be covering book three, and I was texting kind of back and forth with Jack a little bit on this, and he made a comment that, you know, there's some good stuff in here, there's some other stuff, and, you know, would we even be reading this if it wasn't Augustine? And the answer is no. But that's the exact same answer for any biography. I mean, you wouldn't read any biography unless the person had done something worth reading about. And in a sense, when we read biography, which is really just a subgenre of history, reading history can be done one of two ways. We can read history simply for entertainment, simply to see what happened, and, oh, that's neat. Or we can read it to try to learn something to apply in our own lives. That's harder to do, right? It's easy to read history in general and just say, okay, well, on this date, this happened, and on that date, that happened, and move on. And hey, those are interesting things. And there's nothing wrong with reading history in that way, and some people find that enjoyable. But to say, okay, well, these things happened, now what does that mean to me? Right, how can I draw some principles out of it? That's harder to do. It takes an extra step. And one of the things that I think we have to do, particularly the more ancient the history we're reading, is strip the story a little bit of its cultural oddities, right? The things that are different from us, and kind of simplify the narrative so that we can see how it transfers to our time a little bit. So what I want to do is just give you a very simplified outline of book three. Book three is really about a young man, 18, 19 years old, who goes off to Carthage, to a big city, to go to college, right? And he really has no purpose, right? He's in love with being in love, right? He's very lustful, but he doesn't have much of a purpose, right? He's going to school because, well, mom and dad wanted him to get a good education. He's pretty good at it, and you got to get a job at some point. And so he's going off, but he's not really driven by anything particularly at this time other than his lusts. While he's there, he's awakened by a book. It's a non-Christian book. He doesn't come to salvation at this time, but he reads a book that changes his life, right? And then he rejects his parents' faith. Right? He goes back, he reads the Bible and says, eh, rubbish. Right? And not even well-written rubbish at that. And so he abandons his parents' faith. And then he joins a cult. Right? He joins up with people of a different worldview. And all through that, he has a mother that's praying for him. And I skipped ahead too far. He's got a mother that's praying for him. That's really the outline of book three. If you strip the philosophy out of it, strip the culture out of it, that's a story you could hear from anybody you know today, right? I meant to look it up on the way here and I forgot. But the percentage of kids raised in Christian homes that go off to a secular college and abandon the faith of their parents is staggering. Yeah, I mean, it's high. This is a very common story, right? Which means we can relate to it, which means there might be things we can learn there, right? So I encourage you, as you're reading through this, try to step back a little bit and say, okay, what's the just a broad picture here, and how does that relate to today? So with that, I want to kind of go through each chapter in kind of a broad or a detailed outline. He begins in chapter 1 talking about the skillet of outrageous love. He's 18, 19 years old. He goes to Carthage. Carthage is kind of like the New York City of the day or the Los Angeles of the day. It's not quite Rome, but it's close, which means anything you want, you can get in Carthage, right? Any pleasure can be found there.
It's a major port city.
Yeah, it's a, yeah. Yeah, it's a major port city. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. Just everything is there. It's a major place to be. And he goes there, and he's going there as a kind of a normal 18, 19-year-old guy, right, with lots of lusts. And he can find all of them fulfilled there. Of course, none of them actually fulfill anything, which is kind of the problem. And I want to just read through chapter 1, because it actually, I think this is a really beautiful chapter in general. But he says, I came to Carthage, to the center of a skillet where outrageous love affairs hissed all around me. I wasn't in love yet, but I was in love with the prospect of being in love. Has anybody ever experienced that? Right. Has anybody ever known like a fifth grade boy who meets a girl and she dumps him 2 weeks later and he thinks the world has ended? Was he in love? He doesn't even know what love is, right? But he was in love with the idea of being in love, right? And that's where Augustine says he is. And in my more latent need, I hated myself because that need wasn't greater. I looked for something to love, lover of loving that I was, and I hated my safety and my path free of mousetraps, since my real hunger was inside me and was a more inward food. It was for you, my God. He's reflecting back. What I was actually searching for could only be found in God, but I didn't know it. He says, but I didn't feel that starving need. I didn't desire that nourishment that wouldn't rot, not because I was full of that, but because the emptier I was, the pickier I was. What does he mean by that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The more and more he's trying to fill a God-shaped hole in his heart with other things and realizing none of them are working, the pickier he is about trying to fill the hole and still getting nowhere. Therefore, my soul was in bad shape and hurled itself, festering sores and all, out in public, wretchedly insatiable and scratching up against objects of the physical senses. But if these didn't have a soul, they wouldn't do as objects for love. To love and to be loved was sweet to me, and more so if I could enjoy the body of someone who loved me. Right? He wasn't in love with just amassing stuff. Okay? He's not just a materialist in that sense. He's not looking for a better chariot and these sorts of things. What he wants is to be loved by other people and to love them. And if he can enjoy them physically, that's even better. Right? That meant I was in the habit of polluting the shared channel of friendship with putrid rutting and clouding its pale purity with a lust from hell. This is a theme that runs throughout Augustine. We're going to see it even more in Book 4, the role of friendship for him. And he recognizes, to use the phrase from Book 2, he's being an unfriendly friend during this time because he's not pointing anyone to what really matters. Though I was revolting and degraded, I nevertheless yearned, in my overflowing, inane emptiness, to be fashionable and sophisticated. Right? So he's going out in public, and he's trying to put on a show, essentially. He wants to be well thought of, even though inside he's empty. I swooped recklessly into love, only panting to be its prisoner. You, my God, who are my mercy, with how much gall did you sprinkle that sweet taste, and how good you were to do it. He says, in all of my pleasure sinking, you gave me gall, bitterness, and you were right to do so. You were actually good in doing so because it drove me beyond those things eventually to you. Because I was loved in turn and on the sly, I made my way to the shackles of gratification and was gleefully trussed up in those afflicting bonds so that I could be flogged with the fiery iron rods of jealousy and bouts of paranoia and anxieties and rages and brawls. Right? He was caught up in all of it. He was shackled by his sin. And he recognizes the grace of God in that. Right? So that's kind of chapter 1. It's kind of a transition from book 2 to book 3. Then we come to chapters 2 through 4. And he deals with this kind of love affair with sorrow. And we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on this, but he begins to ask questions about, he's a lover of the theater. And he's probing into that. What exactly does he love about it? So why do we enjoy watching tragedies? Okay, how does it make us feel? Do we find enjoyment in it? Well, I'm not entirely sure if it's sick and twisted necessarily, but it is weird, right? How do we feel if we're watching a tragic movie and the people act poorly? The actors don't act well. We feel let down, right? If we're not moved by it, we feel like we got gypped, right? We want them to act really well. I'm going to come to you in just a second, Jack. Has anyone ever watched a TV show, a movie, heard a piece of music, read a book, whatever, that made you cry? I know you have. Okay, now, here's the really interesting question. Who has ever watched it again? Okay, so again, we're not gonna spend a whole lot of time here, but what is it about that that we know this is gonna be sad and it's gonna make us cry and we'll plop it in again? Right? Well, a lot of times there's good endings. Sometimes there's not.
You know. Some creates a catharsis. Mm-hmm. Like the stress in your life, you're able to channel it into this one session of weeping, and it feels kind of cleansing, and you know, you're able to have an outlet for whatever else is going on in your life. Indeed, but in some ways too, like we get so busy and we're so desensitized to everything around us to have like a pure, true, distilled emotion, even if it's horror. Mm-hmm. Right, is in some way enlivening. It makes you feel like, you know, your senses are titillated in some way that you're not normally by your everyday go to Walmart, go home.
It's a really strange thing. I don't have all the answers to it, and we could spend the whole time talking about it. But it's just an interesting thing. Augustine's like really reflecting on why do I like the things I like, Jack?
In listening to the conversation, I just had the opportunity to be on the 64 after 5 o'clock over the past couple of days, and I was amazed at people slowing down to see wrecks. On the other side is faced with bumper and the people on the side that the track is clear, they're all slowing down and looking. I looked at that thinking of this book, thinking to myself, what am I looking at?
And he makes a really important point. He says empathy is a good thing, but he says real true empathy, and like in that situation, would be looking over there with concern for the people in the accident. And most of the time, that's not what we're looking for. How bad's that, right? Or if you watch NASCAR, you kind of like to see a wreck every now and then, right? That's not necessarily a good thing, right? And so Augustine's wrestling with this. Again, we don't have time to dwell on it, but he's wrestling with why do I like the things I like? He goes on to talk about distant mercy and enslaved freedom. He says, your mercy, faithful from a distance, was hovering above me. Right? It's this hound of heaven motif all throughout the book. He recognizes that even though he feels that he's getting farther and farther away from God, God's right there. Right? And even in the punishments for his sin, the judgments against his sin, is the mercy of God for him, right? He recognizes that. He said that during this time, he's placing altogether too much faith in my own stiff-necked will, and that made me retreat far from you because I loved my paths and not yours, because I was in love with the freedom of a runaway slave. Now, what does he mean by the freedom of a runaway slave? Yeah.
Well, there's nobody in charge of you, but you're actually always in fear.
You're never really free. right? You have an illusion of freedom. And in the there's a great course on this, and one of the professors in that makes the analogy here. He says it's almost like a prisoner in jail going through the lunch line, getting his tray of food, and then just slinging it across the thing and said, you know, you're not in charge of me. Right? But he's still in jail, right? And you're still going to go to bed when they tell you to go to bed. I mean, but how often do we act like that? How often do we act like that prior to coming to salvation, right? That's entirely, we thought we were in charge. We thought we were the captain of our own ship, right? But we had the freedom of a runaway slave. Chapter 6, he talks about the demolition men. Who are the demolition men? So again, if we try to put this into kind of modern context, this was a fraternity, right? This was a fraternity that hazed freshmen. And that's exactly what they did, right? This was a group of guys that went around pulling pranks on freshmen. Now, Augustine wasn't one of them, but occasionally he went along with them and enjoyed some of the pranks, and he certainly laughed at the pranks. But he recognizes, looking back, that these people were actually demonic, right? And he has a line where he says, "The demons who pull their pranks unseen laugh at them while leading them by the nose," leading these demolition men by the nose, "which is the exact way they love to treat their own victims." They're just given to cruelty for no reason. Books 7 and 8, we see Augustine's first conversion. Scholars will often refer to three conversions in Augustine. They only mean Christian conversion in one of them. But there's a certain conversion that takes place in chapters 7 and 8. Augustine is fairly devoid of purpose. Again, he's going to school because that's what mom and dad want him to do. I'm not even sure he chose his profession. You kind of get the sense, as he's talked about it thus far, that they had this planned out early on. You know, hey, he's a pretty good talker, right? He's pretty sharp. Let's get him into law and politics, right? That'll be good for us. And so he's doing extremely well in his studies, but he doesn't have a driving purpose behind it. And then he reads Cicero's Hortensius, or Hortensius, or however you want to pronounce it. Has anybody ever read that? I was really hoping somebody had. It's been lost for about 1,000 years or more, right? So nobody's read it. I don't think Augustine was the last to read it, but it hasn't been read for a very long time. We have no idea what's in it, other than the fact that it was a call to love and pursue truth. And it gave Augustine a vision of living for something more than himself. And it changed him. And if you look at the way he talks about how it changed his desires and what he took pleasure in. Now, he's still going to enjoy all the same lusts from before, but he's also seeking, okay, what's really true, right? Let me devote my life to that, all right? Now, has anyone here ever been impacted, either prior to or after salvation, by a non-Christian book in a significant way? Okay, what book?
The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman.
Okay. Anybody else been impacted significantly by a non-Christian book?
The Cave.
What's
not a book?
Is that Plato? Plato's Cave, okay. I'm a big fan of book lists. I'll never read most of them, but I love book lists, right? Well, if it says 10 books that this guy recommended, I'm probably going to look at the list. I'll probably add some of them to my Amazon wish list and then never read them. Elon, Bill Gates, you know, any of the top thinkers of our day, I'm curious to see what they're reading. If you look at most top 10 lists today, there's three books, non-Christian books, that are repeated again and again and again. Does anybody know what any of them are? You want to take a guess? No. Well, it depends on the particular person you're looking at, but that's a fairly niche one. The ones that I've found most common are Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Now think about that. That's one of the ones that's on every list I've seen, just about. Man's Search for Meaning. People are looking for something bigger than themselves. The second is, and this is a more contemporary one, but Yuval Harari's Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. People want to know where we came from. Right? And then Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. Right? Stoic philosophy is very vogue today. Right? Yeah. If you watch the news, sometimes you think college kids are just not very intelligent, right? And don't care about much of anything. But there's an awful lot of people out in the world that are really looking for something more than themselves. They're trying to understand where they came from, where they're going, and how to live the good life, right? We should not discount that, or we should at least take note of that. So Augustine reads the Hortensius. He's enthralled by it, enthralled by the search for wisdom. But, you know, he's got this Christian mom who keeps talking about the truth. And you know, he may have even heard her talk about Jesus being the way, the truth, and the life. So he says, maybe I should pick up the Bible, right? I should probably read that at some point. That's a big book. And so he reads it. And what does he think about it? Not much. This might be okay for little kids, but it's pretty poorly written. It's not very well organized. It doesn't make good arguments. Doesn't make any sense. That's kind of his opinion of Scripture. Yeah. Now, in the Great Courses series, they make the point that that may have been compounded by the fact that he's not reading it in the Hebrew or Greek. He's reading a translation, which might not even be a good translation. Right? He's reading the Latin Vulgate at that time. So that may have compounded, but regardless, he doesn't think it's very eloquent. And his entire training up to this point has been all about being eloquent. And so he rejects it. Now, looking back, he says, and lo and behold, the subject matter wasn't factual in pretentious people's opinion, or laid straightforwardly bare for children's eyes either. But lowly when I stepped toward her, toward the truth of Scripture, of lofty dignity when I came up close and veiled in mysteries. But back then, I wasn't the sort of person who could enter into her or bend my neck submissively to follow her own strides. He recognizes that the natural man does not understand the things of the Spirit. Right? Now, at the time, he just thought, I'm a really smart guy, and all this looks really dumb. Right? But he recognizes that the problem was he was unregenerate. Now, I don't know if anybody here has had that experience, but just a little personal testimony. When I first went to the Marine Corps, went to 29 Palms for school, I would have told you I was a Christian. My parents were Christian. I believed in God, and that was about the extent of it. And so I get to 29 Palms. I'm not a reader, right? I don't like reading at all. I graduated high school without ever reading an entire book cover to cover. But I get to 29 Palms. I get to 29 Palms, and I'm like, okay, I should probably read the Bible at some point. And so I start, and I make it to about maybe Leviticus, and then I stop. And none of it makes a lick of sense, right? Now, that was problematic later on in my life when I did get saved because I was in a King James-only context, and I said, oh, well, that was the problem. I didn't have a King James Bible. That wasn't the problem, right? The problem was I wasn't a believer. And once I became a believer, I started reading it, and things made sense, and I loved it, right? And so that's Augustine's experience. He recognizes that as an unbeliever, it didn't make any sense. And it wasn't going to make sense. Now, you almost get the sense, this is the first time Augustine's read the Bible, which is, it raises questions, right? If his mom's a believer, did she take him to church? I asked Dr. Montgomery, my church history professor, about this last week, and he said, probably, but we don't necessarily know. So, Patricius' dad was an unbeliever up until he was about 16, so it's possible Patricius didn't want Monica taking him to church up to that point. We don't know. But you don't get the sense he's very familiar with the scriptures at all, or Christian theology at all. But he knows mom's a believer, and he loves mom, right? And so he's dealing with that. So he goes to scripture, not terribly impressed by it. Chapters 10 through 18, the Manichaean snare. In chapter 10, he mentions a platter of phantasms. I gave you a couple articles to read on Manichaeism. I don't know if anybody did, but essentially, Manichaeism was kind of the end result of Gnosticism, right? It was a highly reformed version of Gnosticism, which essentially said, material things are bad, spiritual things are good. And sometimes spiritual things get trapped inside of material things, and we've got to get them out. That's essentially their view. That there was this big war between light and darkness, between the spiritual and the material, and we've got to free people from material things. And spiritual things can be contained in people. They can be contained in produce, right? He talks about, and it may have seemed strange, he talks about the fig and weeping, and its mother's milk. Has anybody ever plucked a fig from a tree? White liquid comes out. It looks like milk. But the Manichaean view was, well, if you're one of the elect, right, if you're one of the spiritual people, you could consume that fig and separate out the spiritual, the light out of that, and disperse it back into the universe. Right? So you were freeing it. But if I got that same fig and gave it to an unbeliever, I'm condemning that fig to death. I would rather that person starve than give them that fig. That's the Manichaean philosophy, right? And the Manichaeans come in and they ensnare Augustine. And we'll talk about why in a second. Now, he does say in chapter 11 that at this point, poetry and tragedy, which he somewhat disparaged earlier, would have been better for him than false religion. Why do you think he says that?
Yes, it's true.
But why is it true?
Because if you stay in the arts, you can swim freely in humanistic tendencies of mankind. Mm-hmm. If you get trapped in a false religion, you're swimming within blasphemies and heresies. Now, both ultimately are death, but at least sin has a pleasure for a season within the humanities, whereas in the decadence of a heresy, you can have a self-assurance that, and a confidence, a false confidence, that there's salvation in the end.
Yeah, and so the thing that Augustine identifies is that, you know, when he's reading poetry, he knows it's not true. Like, there's no pretense that it's true. But with a false religion, there's false assurance. Because he thinks it's actually true, and therefore it's more dangerous. He said he would have been better off just sticking with the poets instead of the Manichaeans. Moving on, chapters 12 through 18. This is really the heart of the chapter, I think, and I think where we can get the most benefit. He talks about the susceptibility of biblical ignorance. And in chapter 12, the Manichaeans address three theological topics with him that convince him that they've got the answers and the Bible doesn't. And those three topics are theodicy, anthropomorphism, and situational ethics. Theodicy is just a fancy term for the problem of evil. if God exists and he is good, then why is there evil? That's a fair question, right? How can God be just and evil exist? Where did evil come from? That's one of the things they throw out at him, and he doesn't have an answer, right? He doesn't know a scriptural answer to that. The second is anthropomorphism. The Bible speaks of God's feet, his arms, his breath, etc. So does God have eyebrows? Does he have fingernails? These are the actual questions the Manichaeans are putting to him, and Augustine doesn't know how to answer them. Because, well, yeah, the Bible does say God has arms, and if you have arms, you probably have hands, which means you probably have fingernails, but that seems weird. And so he doesn't know what to do with that. And then the third one, and this seems to be the most significant because he elaborates on this one as he goes forth, is situational ethics. Does the standard of righteousness change from age to age or place to place? It's a really important question. It really is. Now, situational ethics is a term coined in the 60s, but the concept has been around forever, right? And so he's wrestling with questions like, well, is incest righteous or unrighteous?
Careful.
Well, that's the problem, right? Because was Abraham a righteous man?
Yes. Declared.
Who did he marry?
His half-sister.
His half-sister. So if we all know, because we all know, incest is bad, and Scripture calls him righteous, well, Scripture must be wrong. Right? Yeah. I mean, you have these things, and so Augustine was tripped up by that almost immediately. He's like, oh, yeah, you got a point there, right? And these Manichaeans had lots of answers, right? And he's ensnared by this. And this leads him in chapters 13 to 17 to talk about the faultlessly correct law of the all-powerful God. And there's some beautiful meditations here on the unchanging standard of righteousness. Now, how that unchanging standard of righteousness applies in different situations, in different cultures, maybe may look different outwardly, but there is an inward standard that does not change according to him. What are some of the things that Augustine identifies as unchanging laws? Things that are always right in every place and every time. I'll give you a hint. It's the two greatest commandments. He said it is always right to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't matter when you live, where you live, those two things are always right. What that might look like in your culture might look different from another culture, but those two laws are true all the time, everywhere. And then he identifies some things that are wrong in every place and every time. Specifically, he identifies one sin in that category. What sin is that? It's the sin of homosexuality, which is really interesting. Sometimes I think we think America came up with that. We didn't, right? We didn't perfect it either, right? Rome had rampant homosexuality. There were emperors who practiced homosexuality, right? And Augustine recognizes, and even in his day, that's wrong in every culture at every time, right? It's one of those things that's against nature. He says, in the same way, shameful acts that are contrary to nature, such as those committed by the people of Sodom, are reviled and punished everywhere and always. If all nations did these things, they would all be arraigned for the same crime by the divine law, which didn't create humankind to have intercourse in this way. This is because the critical bond that ought to be between us and God is outraged when human nature, of which he's the source, is sullied by this twisted libidinousness. Right? He has some very strong things to say about homosexuality. And then he talks about this enduring standard of righteousness. And where does he say that? What does he say is the enduring standard of righteousness, and where is it best expressed? What is the standard of everything true, good, and beautiful? God. God is the ultimate source. He is goodness. He is truth. He is beauty. He is the standard of those things. And where do we see best expressed his eternal law? His immutable, faultlessly correct law. In his word, but where specifically in his word does Augustine turn? And I'll give you a hint. We just finished a long study on this particular passage. The Ten Commandments. So the concept that the Ten Commandments is essentially God's immutable moral law is not a new thing, right? The churches believe this for its entirety. But he has a beautiful way of referring to the Ten Commandments, which I may borrow from here forth. Does anybody remember what that was? He called it the sum of the three and the seven, the ten-stringed harp. Right? He says, in any event, these are the principal postulates of evil that break out from a penchant for primacy, or for ogling, or for physical sensations, one or two of these, or all three together, and it's a bad life in defiance of that sum of three and seven, your harp with ten chords, the Ten Commandments given by you, God, the highest and sweetest being. I think it's a beautiful way to refer to the Ten Commandments, the ten-stringed harp. Right? Now, why does he say the sum of three and seven? He's referring to the first table and the second table. But isn't the first table the first four? Well, if you remember back to when our study on the Ten Commandments, Catholics and Lutherans count one way. Reformed people count another way. Jewish people count another way. Essentially, they took the first two commandments and combined them and took the tenth commandment and split it. So when he says the first three, that would be the first four for us. Right? That's just the way he's referring to that. So going on, before we run completely out of time, chapter 18, he talks about some Manichaean twaddle. This is where he talks about the fig, and I'm not going to go into depth about that. But looking back, he's looking at how absolutely ridiculous this cult was. But most people, when they're in a cult, can't see it. Right? Then in chapter 19, we see the tears of a committed Christian mother. How did Augustine describe his father in books 1 and 2? His father in book 1 wasn't a believer at all and just cared about his education and getting a job. By book 2, his dad's a convert, but a recent one, and still primarily concerned with earthly things. How does he describe his dad in book 3? Dead. Dead for 3 years. He was 16... 15-16 in book 2, 18-19 in book 3. His dad was a recent convert in book 2, which means his dad died shortly after coming to faith. And he says almost nothing about his dad's death other than that, which says a lot in not saying anything. He probably didn't have the greatest relationship with his dad. When we get to book 4, he's going to have a long section about the death of a friend. He doesn't even mention his name. And he spends a lot of time talking about his death. How does he talk about Monica in the first two books? Not a ton. She is a believer. But if you think back to book 2, she's left the city of Babylon, but is still dwelling in its outer districts. Right? She is a believer, but her priorities are all wrong. Right? How does he describe her in book 3? Yeah, he says, my mother, your committed Christian, was weeping in your presence for me more than mothers weep for the death of their children's bodies. Through the faith and the spirit she possessed from you, she saw my death, and you gave ear to her pleas, Master. You listened to her and didn't look down on her tears when in every place she prayed, the water gushing out of her eyes drenched the ground. You listened. You get the impression there's been a great deal of maturity between book two and book three. Right? She's now preoccupied with the most important things, his eternal destiny. She can see his death. And then she has a dream, and I'm going to move quickly because we've got to get some application. But she has this dream, and there's this ruler, and she's standing on it, and he's standing right next to her. And the angel tells her, where you are, he will be too. When we get to chapter 20, we can see that she's a chaste, pious, sober widow, and she's lighthearted by this hope. She tells Augustine this dream, and he says, well, how do you know that doesn't mean you'll be where I am? And she goes, oh, no, that's not what the angel said. And she corrects him. And I'm not going to go into dreams and things like that. But she finds hope in this. Now, did God immediately save Augustine? No. It's at least another 8 or 9 years, close to a decade. But she has some hope, right? And she submits to living with him and sharing the same table during this time. So she begins accompanying him from here on out. She doesn't like the way he's living. She's appalled by it. But she's got hope, and she continues to persevere in her prayers. Augustine says, around 8 years followed, during which I rolled around in the mud of that deep pit and in darkness of that lie, often trying to rise out of it, but always taking a more forceful plunge back in. She, meanwhile, a chaste, pious, and sober widow, such as you love, was already more lighthearted with hope, but she didn't slack in weeping and groaning. She didn't cease in all the hours of her prayers to beat her breast before you, and her pleas were granted an audience with you. And yet, you left me to wallow and be swallowed in that darkness. So, she's got this dream, but she doesn't say, okay, we're good. I don't have to worry about him anymore. She continues to pray for him again and again and again with tears. And then she goes to her pastor, a deeply learned, unwilling, annoyed pastor. And she says, can you please go talk to my son? Can you convince him to get out of this Manichaean cult? And he says, look, I'm not going to go talk to him because it's not going to do any good. I was there before. I was in that same cult. He's going to have to come out of it on its own. And she presses, could you please go talk to him? And now he's talked to other kids. I mean, it's not he's unwilling to do that completely, but he knows at this point it's not going to do any good. And she's just pleading with him and annoying him. And so he finally says, just keep praying, go away, the son of so many tears can't be lost. Which she takes as a prophecy from God. And I'm not saying it is. I think he was just annoyed and trying to get her to leave. But you see how great her concern is, right? Now, we're out of time, but I do want to talk about some applications. I'm going to give you four real quick that I think we can draw from this chapter, and I encourage you to meditate and see how many more you can think of. So, the first is the need for instructing children in biblical truths. He seems to have gone 18 years of his life without ever knowing any basic Christian doctrine. One of the great things I think we can do is teach our kids the catechism. Even if they don't believe it at this point, they're at least understanding what Christians do believe. So that when they hear something contrary, they're like, well, actually, that's not what Christians believe, right? Because I've studied it. I don't think we should discount that. Pastor Ben has made mention of this many times. He got saved later in life. But things that he learned as a spark? Sunbeam. As a sunbeam, are still in there, right? So don't discount the need for teaching biblical truths to children. The second thing, the impact of a praying parent. Right? I think this is really significant. Augustine doesn't just know that his mom prayed for him. He knows because he's heard it, because he's seen it. He's seen her tears, and that made an impact. The need for perseverance, right? She didn't just pray once. She prayed for hours every place she went, weeping for his salvation. And then the fourth one, you may have heard there's a famous maxim in investing that says, the best time to invest was yesterday, the second best time is today. Right? Well, the same is true in spiritual things. The best time to get serious about our loved one's salvation is yesterday. Right? The second best time is now. So I think there's some real encouragement here. For, let's say, 16 years of Augustine's life, his mom's a believer, but has all the wrong priorities. But when she matured, she started praying for her son. It was never too late for her to say, I'm going to take this seriously. And so I think to some degree we can think, well, I've messed it up, right? I mean, they're 30. What am I going to do now? Pray for them, right? You may have messed it up for 30 years. Forget what's gone behind. Start praying for them, pleading for them, right? And you may have to plead with them another decade, another two decades. But God does honor our prayers.